You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody.
Feels like a long time. It's a long time since we talked. I know it's been just a week, but
we haven't interacted as much this week as we normally do.
That's true.
Like with the texts and stuff.
That's it. I had a 4-day weekend school-wise, so I've been buried with childcare, which makes me lose all sense of time and space.
Yeah, it's a weird time every year. It's a time of adjustment. The weather's starting to change. You know, your schedule, the kids' schedule is always in an uproar. And so maybe it's not surprising that it would impact us here in the relatively safe and warm confines of the DMZ.
So one thing, I probably shouldn't be surprised by this, but so, you know, we have this whole thing in August with Democrats and the infrastructure bill and the budget resolution, which leads into budget reconciliation. And I certainly, like, I knew, you know, cerebrally that the reconciliation process was going to be messy and things wouldn't fall into place neatly. I didn't think things were going to get done by September 27th when now the infrastructure bipartisan bill is scheduled for a vote. So, like, I knew all that, but I didn't quite anticipate this crush of activity this week, where a lot of media outlets really started diving into the internal tensions in the Democratic Party. I guess I'm probably because even when we had the episode in August, there are certain reporters that were on top of it. But with Afghanistan, COVID going on, it felt like this sort of tiny corner of the world that where people cared about this procedural vote. And I'm sure it's still the case that COVID is still down in most people's headspace. But I feel like we had this blast of media activity at the front end of the week where everyone was sort of trying get their heads around what's going on.
I mean, the New York Times had that big front page story about how this was like a cradle to grave. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about the $3.5 trillion. Right.
Hey, Matt,
quote.
I wrote that piece a month ago. So, you know,
yeah,
I wrote the piece in the Washington Monthly that this is literally the biggest bill that's ever been attempted, that this is going to be, this was akin to, you know, Simone Biles doing, you know, one of these, you know, never done before triple, double somersault in the air, stick the landing type of things. So if you want to save yourself a New York Times subscription, you just read me.
Analogy, I think, is that now Joe Biden has a case of the twisties.
Or the yips.
The yips. Yeah, that's where you can't throw to first base from second base. And there's also a How I Met Your Mother, I think, about the yips. But anyway.
But I think people are starting to see how complicated this is. You're really trying to do multiple major bills at one time in one bill, with an uncertain ceiling on how much you're allowed to spend, and try to make all the pieces fit within a framework that is not even all that well defined.
So
that's just very complicated process.
Well, and you're focused, I think, on the procedural and technical and even sort of analysis of can this be done. I'm still with why are we doing this? Like, should this be done? I'm sure there's some good stuff in there. But like, as you noted, this is a whole bunch of stuff. And it's basically just a progressive wish list that they know they can't. That they know they can't sort of do individually, and they're trying to like shove it into one bill. It just seems to me very pushy, and there's something about it that bothers me. I'll just say that.
Well, I mean that's not an unfair characterization, but to be a bit more, you know, positive and charitable, I mean, you can make individual cases for all the things in there. There's a case to make for universal preschool. There's a case to make for free community college. There's a case to make for long-term elder care. There's a case to make for robust investment in climate. There's a case to make for changing the tax code so it's fairer, and so corporations who are getting off the hook are paying their fair share. There's a case to make for heirs paying capital gains tax at a higher rate. You can make cases for all of these things. It's hard to make a case for all these things at the exact same time.
But it's also the case where if you get lucky and you can ram this through, you have, in one fell swoop, dramatically changed the country in a way that most people probably are not even aware that this debate is happening or that we're this. You know what it reminds me of, Bill? It's like once Donald Trump became the Republican nominee, it was kind of like he had a 50-50 shot. You know what I mean? Like once you become the nominee, all bets are off, you know? And the safeguards to prevent someone like Trump from becoming the president. And I kind of feel the same way here. Like, you know, the odds are that they're not going to get all $3.5 trillion or whatever, but they're throwing so much at us that even if we stop, like, some of it, there's going to be a lot of stuff that passes, I'm guessing, and that we haven't really had a national conversation about. We haven't really vetted, and we haven't just, as a society, decided that this is actually what we want to do, right?
Well, yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, there's early poll numbers that are favorable, but the dialogue has not really been joined yet. The debate's not really been joined yet. Now, there's one guy who's actually trying to sell it, and that's Bernie Sanders. You know, you don't really, we talk about messaging and communications and why doesn't the president communicate better, da, da, da. Well, it's very hard for Joe Biden to lead the messaging strategy on this because he's the president. He's got other things he has to do. He's had to talk about Afghanistan for weeks. He's clearly that the administration's recognized that they got to get ahead on COVID still, that they haven't put that to bed, and people want to see leadership on that. Probably more than anything else, they want to get a sense from the president what is the strategy with Delta variant, and that's the speech he's giving today, if I remember correctly. So it's hard for him to be, you know, 24/7 Build Back Better Bill, because he's got other responsibilities. And it's a huge messaging challenge because it is so much stuff.
Right.
Now, so Bernie's out
agree,
there.
But I mean, you know, like the Afghanistan thing, he decided to do this when he decided to do it.
Well, again,
and maybe he could have focused on passing this legislation if that was actually a priority. And so, I mean, presidents make choices. I do want to ask you, but I just want to put a pin in this infrastructure discussion for one question and just ask you about Biden in general. Like, mm-hmm. You know, early on you were saying that, like, Afghanistan, don't worry too much about this because foreign policy generally doesn't, you know, people don't vote on foreign policy and all that. And I think historically you made a pretty compelling case. Having said that, you know, it does feel like Biden, whether it's COVID or Afghanistan or a combination, is struggling. He does not, unlike Trump and Obama, he does not have a cult of personality to lean on, which means if he starts to lose, you know, the Bill Kristol vote, then that matters, you know. So anyway, what do you just think, generally speaking, how much danger is Biden in right now?
I mean, honestly, I feel like Afghanistan is starting to fade from the headlines. Now, maybe kick up again because something really, you know, tragic happens. But I don't feel like that's dominating the conversation the way it was. Now, whether or not, you know, the damage done to Biden's standing sustains, I mean, I think there's a question whether did Biden lose this reputation for competence because of this? And so even if Afghanistan calms down from an American perspective, does that impression sustain and keep Biden in the mid-40s until something new happens to, you know, jolt him out of that? Like, say, passing a giant Build Back Better bill, or the Delta variant, you know, spike subsiding. That remains to be seen.
I mean, it even seems like anything, even passing you know, legislation, which, you know, I think will obviously give him, like, he's putting points on the board, right? We tend to equate activity and accomplishment with success, but
sometimes, like, not always.
We tend to. He's going to certainly get a bump if he passes something, but, like, this could spur inflation potentially, right? I mean, so, like, even victories like withdrawing from Afghanistan, he wanted to withdraw. We withdrew, but there is a price to pay for that. And I think even passing legislation like this, which is a lot of money, could be like a Pyrrhic victory.
I don't think inflation is...
Is that how you pronounce that? Pyrrhic?
Yeah.
Pyrrhic?
Pyrrhic.
How do I say that?
Pyrrhic.
Pyrrhic.
For the most part, I don't think inflation is the main concern here for two reasons. One, this is a 10-year bill, so it's not all the money being, you know, shoved in the system, you know, immediately. And number two, the intent is for it to be paid for. Now, it's an open question whether it will be paid for or the pay-fors will be too gimmicky or whatnot. But this is not proposed by Biden as a Keynesian shot of deficit spending. They're supposed to be revenue raisers here. If it literally is...
Meaning taxes, right?
Yeah, whether it's increasing tax rates or closing loopholes or whatever, you're raising revenue. Not a lot of talk about spending cuts so far. If you have a fully offset bill, that's not inflationary. Because the stimulus you bring into the system is offset by what you're taking out of the system. So I don't think inflation is the biggest issue here. Now, if inflation continues to kick up while we're getting these monthly checks for the expanded child tax credit, the child tax credit expansion is a one-year deal in the American Rescue Plan. It needs to be extended if it's going to be essentially permanent policy. I mean, it probably won't be literally permanent. It'll probably be some kind of multi-year extension. But if you do something that's, you know, 3-4 years, there's going to be an expectation you're going to keep doing it. This is one of the, I have a piece coming out for the monthly, should be out later today. And I actually talked to the chair of the New Democrat Coalition. This is not as well known as the Congressional Progressive Caucus, but it's a similar size and it's a more moderate coalition. And, you know, what they want in the bill is a fewer number of initiatives for longer periods of time. So they really want child tax credit expansion for a long-term extension. Now, child tax credit is an expensive line item. It's $100 billion a year. So the longer you put it in the bill, if there's a finite top line, the less room you have for other things.
Spell it out. What is this child tax credit? What does it do?
I mean, right now it's giving people money.
I got two kids. What do I get?
I mean, I've been getting $500 a month for my two kids.
And is it just money you get, or do you have to spend it on childcare?
No, this is just giving you money.
A check you get in the mail because you have kids.
Yes. Now, we've always had a child tax credit. That's not new. But you take that credit when you do your tax returns. And what Biden and Trump increased the child tax credit too. Biden further increased the size of the credit and changed the delivery mechanism. So you automatically get the credit paid out in advance through monthly checks. So you're not taking it off your tax return.
So this is a refundable, right?
Because it's also refundable. Well, the refundability means that even if you don't pay net federal taxes, you still get it. Right. And so that makes it easier to do the monthly checks because it's not contingent upon whether or not you end up paying net taxes at the end of the day.
Interesting. And so these folks you talk to, the moderates would like to basically lock that in.
They want to lock that in. So in that sense, it's a progressive thing. But if you're having a top line, and the new Dems haven't insisted on what the top line should be, but they all know there's going to be a top line, there's going to be a ceiling. I mean, literally speaking, the budget resolution creates a $3.5 trillion ceiling. They can't go above $3.5 trillion. They could go lower. They can't go over. So again, the longer you do the child tax rate expansion, the less room there is for other stuff. And what the congresswoman said to me was, if you're doing it for, you know, 1 year, 2 years, but in the back of your mind, you know it's going to go longer than that, well, then you're not doing honest budgeting. You're not offsetting the revenue for that. Like maybe you would offset it when you hit that deadline, but that's an uncertainty. And certainly Congress doesn't always do that sort of thing. So to the extent that inflation is a potential issue, if they're being a little gimmicky about that kind of stuff, that does create the risk, more risk for inflation.
But if you, I mean, you know, the taxing part too, if you're going to pay for it by virtue of raising taxes. Now, I think there are ways to raise taxes that are less damaging than other ways, but presumably there could be a cost to that. Like, people operate on incentives. If you start taxing people more, they have less money to spend. Whether that means they don't build a factory or whatever, if it's an individual consumer or a business, I mean, is there a danger that that would slow the economy or slow innovation or slow growth?
Well, this is the quieter debate that's happening now within the Democratic Party, because the overarching narrative is corporations aren't paying their fair share. Too many aren't paying anything at all. We need to raise rates. We need to close loopholes. And so we can pay for these very robust investments without raising a dime on the middle class or the poor, because all that we have to do is get corporations to pay their fair share. There's clearly a smaller but perhaps important contingent of Democrats saying, yeah, but we got to be careful with this stuff because we don't want to hurt competitiveness. We don't want to hamstring imported industries. We want, you know, there's a push from the White House to have a global minimum tax. So you don't have these tax shelters where people can park their money at the Cayman Islands and stuff. So everyone's got to pay at least a minimum 15%. And there's some Democrats saying, okay, but we already paid 21%, and now, Biden, you want 28, Joe Manchin wants 25, we're probably going to go more like 25, but then if other places are doing 15, people, there's still an incentive to shift your cash elsewhere. So there's all these complicated questions. And, of course, the extent that Democrats are pushing those points, they're vulnerable from progressives saying, hey, you don't care about competitiveness, you're just flacking for your wealthy donors. This is yeah, why this whole business is so corrupt in the first place. You're making Democrats look bad. So it's a very touchy subject to debate. And so just to go, and if I can circle back to where we were before, Bernie's out there. Bernie's the main guy trying to put an overarching narrative to all this, make it all make sense for people. But he's not in charge of the entire process. He's selling a bill that doesn't exist yet, because there are all these sub-issues being hashed out and we don't know where the bill is going to land. And that makes the messaging project very difficult. That's why Bernie is on his own, because everyone else in the party can't sell the same message for what is still a work in progress.
And I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but Bernie Sanders, I mean, he has a track record of inspiring, you know, progressives, but he does not really have a track record of carrying major legislation, does he?
That's a little unfair. I mean, for most of his senatorial career, he, you know, they call him the Amendment King. You know, that was what they sold him as in this presidential campaign. It's not an illegitimate moniker. He was really good at, like, sort of picking his spots, like putting a progressive amendment, tacking onto a bill, and calling it a victory, which is not a bad thing for a backbencher congressperson or senator to do. As chair of the VA committee or ranking member, I can't forget what it was at the time, he did work on VA reform with John McCain and put together a compromise bill. It hardly was a socialist bill. It had a fair amount of room for, you know, private medical care in that bill. So this is not completely foreign for Bernie to be involved in legislation. Having said that, nobody has ever put together a bill of this magnitude. I mean, the New Deal was not one bill. It was dozens of bills. So this is highly, highly unusual for everybody. And yeah. Bernie's function here, I mean, he is trying very hard to be the left pole and not be the guy who's cutting the deal.
You know, just as a conservative, I am always concerned about, unintended consequences and aware of complexity. And, you know, it's the fatal conceit to do central planning because the world is too complex. And this is from, you know, whether it's Hayek or Burke, epistemological modesty is what I think informs, you know, real conservatism. And so this inherently concerns me. And they're doing a whole bunch of stuff that they do not fully understand the ramifications of, the unintended consequences of, and it's so complex and so many things that there's no way that they will have the time or expertise. Like, I would be skeptical that you could fully understand these things anyway, but there's no way that they're going to really know when we tax these people, this is what they're going to do. I mean, there's going to be fallout one way or the other, right? I keep ending sentences with right to try to get you to say, I agree with you.
Well, I agree. I agree that kind of thing is a concern. And look, I've written about this previously because there's a narrative about the Obama years pushed by a pretty broad swath of progressives and Democrats, you know, from like socialists to, you know, more mainstream liberals like an Ezra Klein, that, you know, Obama's big mistake, particularly with Obamacare, was this slow implementation timeline. You know, the benefits weren't manifest by 2010. The Republicans dragged out negotiations for months, and then things didn't get implemented in the second term, and so they got hammered with it in 2010, and they lost the Congress. Whereas if you just, you know, give people what they want, give them stuff, pass things fast, mm-hmm. do big stuff and give them things and people will be happy. And then you win elections. And, you know, I've always pointed out, like, it's never that simple. It takes time for programs to get up and running. There are almost always kinks. There are always problems with implementation. And you want to give people the space to experiment and make mistakes and fix them and learn as you go. So you want to set proper expectations. If you promise the moon and you don't deliver the moon, that's when you get really burned. So you, Matt, as a conservative, like, you might be inclined to say, hey, let's just not do this because who knows what the consequences are going to be. I might say we should do it, but do it with wide eyes and prepare for some bumps in the road so you can fix as you go.
But wouldn't you do it one at a time instead of this omnibus, like, you know, throw everything at the wall kind of thing?
Well,
like,
you know, from a policy standpoint, it doesn't worry me so much because I think it's a big country. We got lots of individuals. People can experiment with multiple things at the same time. You can learn as you go on multiple tracks. As a political matter, it gives me palpitations. You know, it's a high wire act because if you got five things going wrong at the same time, people are going to say you bit off more than you can chew. It may not be a fair charge, but people might feel that way. Now, maybe one more point here.
Sure.
So one thing that progressives want is to expand Medicare to include vision, hearing, and dental. They think this could be a real, you know, good substantively and good politically, you know, a concrete benefit. You know, this is expensive stuff on the shoulders of seniors, and then boom, now it's free. Now my hearing aids are free, my glasses are free. You know, I can touch and feel that right away. So let's push that. And the more moderate side, and I think the more the establishment side on this one, is, you know, that's expensive stuff. You know, we just enhanced Obamacare subsidies and the American Rescue Plan. Let's extend that. That's going to shore up Obamacare. And look, it's not as easy to create a new benefit for hearing, dental, and vision overnight the way you think it is. It's going to take some time to figure out all the reimbursement formulas, so the doctors can still get paid well. It's not an instantaneous process. So what just came out of the House Ways and Means Committee as a first draft was to do the hearing and the vision a little quicker, a year or two. But the dental, which is the most expensive of the three, wouldn't kick in until 2028. So one, it's a money saver. It's you're keeping the cost down for the overall price tag of the bill. And you're giving yourself a lot of run-up time to handle those implementation issues. And progressives are upset about that. Bernie's upset about that. But I do think that there's less appreciation on the progressive side on the implementation concerns, both substantively and politically. But that is being hashed out in the course of this negotiation.
And what I find interesting about this, aside from the actual topic, is you, which are, you know, what's the whole thing about like Whig means and, you know, whatever that line is about British politics. But like you want to do something pretty radical, but in a conservative, cautious, prudent kind of Burkean way, which I find interesting. And I wanted to ask you, Bill, did you do this New York Times Lee Drutman test yesterday? He had a column saying maybe there should be six political parties instead of two. And you could take this 20-question test. And I took it. And I'd love to know if you did.
I didn't. I saw it. I'm annoyed by it. I hate this whole romanticization of multi-party systems. And I didn't want to give it the credence by participating in it.
Well, I mean, is your problem that, you know, for some reason people are – they're not content with the American sort of two-party system and that they have these fantasies that if we just had more parties, everything would be fixed or something?
Yeah, I think people have – there's a certain class of person and you know, you would understand probably be one of those people who doesn't feel like the two major parties give them a home. They don't like their identity being attached to a party they don't fully agree with on some major subjects. So they'd rather have an identity that they feel is closer to them. So I want to be a Green, or I want to be a National Security Patriot Party, or I want to be a Right to Life Party. Don't force me into this box. But that's, honestly, that's selfish. I mean, that is like, I want to feel good about my individual party and vote for something that fully reflects me. So when I wear a t-shirt, I wear a hat with a party label on, I feel like I'm representing me. And that's not good governance, in my opinion. You're creating, I mean, look at Israel's government. They can barely keep a government together because they have these balkanized elections that don't produce winners. And they have to put together very awkward coalitions just to, you know, exist. And then the governments last for 6 months because one faction doesn't like a position, and then the whole government collapses. You have to have an election all over again. Italy's been like this way for decades. Canada's having an election right now. I mean, again, we don't know how it's going to turn out. They have a situation where their conservative side of the country is not as big as their center-left side, but their center-left is divided between the liberals and the New Democrats. And for a long time, conservatives were running the country, even though they weren't a majority because the left was divided. Then Trudeau came in, managed of a majority government, but then he lost the majority government in his reelection. Still was prime minister, but in a minority government. And in Canada, you can call your own election. So Trudeau said, you know what, we're riding pretty high. Let's call an election and give ourselves a majority. Then apparently people were mad at Trudeau for being Machiavellian. And now the New Democrats are riding high. The liberals are in the 20s. The New Dems are around 20. And the conservatives might take over the whole thing because the left is divided because people have to have their own personal party for themselves.
Right.
So I don't care about that system in any respect.
I was perfectly content being a part of a coalition calling itself the Republican Party for about four decades. But I think recent events have rendered me homeless. But I sympathize with you, the general thrust of what you're saying. Now, here's the deal, though. This New York Times thing, I took this test, and I'm sure it's very flawed, as they all are, but I didn't do it because I actually want there to be six political parties. Mm-hmm. I did it as a means of, like, introspection and self-reflection and to see if it told me something about me. And by the way, I haven't got my wife to take it yet, but my my two sons took it. My oldest boy ended up exactly where I was almost in the Growth and Opportunity Party. My youngest boy is a member of the Christian Conservative Party. So he's more socially conservative than I am. He's the one who judges me for my drinking and swearing and things like that. I didn't like the fact that if you read about the Growth and Opportunity Party that I allegedly now belong to, that they kind of compared it to Rockefeller Republicans, you know, which I don't think is an accurate description of me. But
there must anyway, have been, there must have been an abortion question built, in there, right?
What's that?
There must have been an abortion question, right?
Oh, there was an abortion question. I think I was a little too squishy on it. Matt, you know, the problem is
God is watching you, Matt.
I know. I worry about that all the time. The problem is that like life is complex and that there are nuances and, you know, saying yes, no, or maybe like doesn't always provide me with enough room, I guess, to adequately express where I stand on things. So, but here's the thing about tests. It forces you to make choices and that means something. And Bill, I think I would love for you to take this test.
Fine.
Because I think it might tell us something about you.
But the whole thing, I mean, it's like, you know, for the longest time, there would always be these online survey questions like, you know, here are all your, take all these issue positions and see what candidate you like. So this happened a lot in like 2004, 2008. And it was always designed to land you on Denis Kucinich. That was the whole game because you pick like the most perfectly liberal.
They wanted you to land on Denis Kucinich.
Right. They want you to like pick every, you know, pure liberal progressive position and be like, oh my goodness, I'm with Denis Kucinich. I had no idea. Let me check out this Denis Kucinich guy. As if there are no other factors that would go into a decision on a candidate than just checking off a box on a survey. I know Drutman's work. Like, Drutman wants multi-party democracy. Like, he's trying to create a survey to make you think about and make you be intrigued by what this world could be if we could have multi-party democracy, without talking about all the downsides of multi-party democracy.
Look, I'm with you. I'm with you on that. But I will say, in defense of Drutman, it does seem, and maybe this is because I'm on the right side of the spectrum, but it does seem to me more plausible to say that, like, J.D. Vance and I really shouldn't be in the same political party. Like there's – it's becoming increasingly clear to me that it's – that there are people in the conservative movement and the Republican Party – that have nothing in common with me. Like, our worldviews are dramatically different. I would say I'm more conservative than them, to be honest with you. Yeah. But it's partly the contingent on what your definition is. You know, and like Jonah Goldberg says, you know, one of his definitions is it's about being grateful, thankfulness, being grateful for this blessing that we have and wanting to conserve it and preserve it. But like, where we come down is so different. Like, I am not sure we really belong in the same party.
But you're looking at it in terms of, like, who do I want to hang out with? Who do I want to socialize with? Who do I want to identify with?
No, and that's not it.
I mean, it's
no. It's like everything that they believe and the conclusions that they draw are the opposite of mine. It's not like.
But you've already gone through this. You've gone through this with Trump. You've been a Republican in the era of Trump. And for a lot of it, Matt Lewis, like, you know what? I like what Trump did on judges. I like what Trump did on taxes. There are certain common threads that connect you with people who are abhorrent. and same on the left.
Thank you.
There are people who I, you know, have a lot of major problems with on the left. But as a governing reality, I want to and need to be on the same team with them if anything I want to have happen become to happen. You have to be able to have a governing system which allows action to occur and not be paralyzed by constant squabbling. And essentially what a two-party system does is it pre-cooks a lot of compromising. You don't have to you don't have to reinvent the wheel at the point of every election and like renegotiate every last little thing. And it's one thing for a smaller country to have to be able to do that. But if I may be exceptionalist for a bit, they're not America. America has to function for the world to function. We don't have the luxury of being Italy. We don't have the luxury of governments rising and falling every 6 months.
I'm with you on the concept of consensus and two political parties. I'm fine with that. I just think that maybe we're going through a patch right now where there's a reordering and all that, and it's messy right now because it doesn't shake out. And as I wrote in the Daily Beast recently, nobody wants the Never Trumpers. And by Never Trumpers, I don't mean Max Boot and Jen Rubin and Bill Kristol and Jonah Goldberg and whoever, Tim Miller, just get on the list, Amanda Carpenter. I mean the tens of thousands of people who voted for other Republicans but not Donald Trump. Nobody wants those votes. Biden is not doing what he would presumably be doing if his goal were to win those votes. And the Republicans do not want those votes either. So,
I don't think it's totally fair. I think the Democrats are of two minds here. I think on one level, they believe that doing stuff, delivering good things, is how you keep those people around. They may not call themselves progressives. They may not have their eyes light up. You talk about $3.5 trillion, but if you give them something, they're going to be happy, and we're going to actually build out our coalition this way. And I think there's some cognitive dissonance here. I think there's also a fear that, we're so screwed in this midterm. There's no way we're getting past this midterm. This is our one shot. And even if we lose everything, at least we're going to bake in some policy. That's not just out of selfishness. They think it's going to be good policy that's going to help people. And we got to take our shot. And this is why there's only, one more opportunity for a reconciliation bill that's filibuster proof, and we got to jam everything into it while we got it. And that's why you're doing everything all at once, to circle back to, we're at the beginning of the conversation. So I think there was more optimism closer to January that doing this would be good electorally in the short run. I think we're tipping to, we have to do this because we have no other chance to do it. And mind you, it still is not removed from electoral considerations, because it may be the Democrats are saying, look, we're screwed in the midterm, but we got to show something for 2024. And at least we'll have those 2 years of this policy that's locked in, that we can go back to the public and say, look, we did this. We did this for you. If you want to keep this going, you got to reelect Joe Biden or elect Kamala or whoever it is.
Bill, sadly, I have to jump and write a column, but we should probably just acknowledge and maybe talk for a minute about 9/11, which when this posts, we're taping this Thursday, we're going to be, coming up on the 20th anniversary of 9/11, I think Saturday, right?
Saturday, yes.
So any thoughts on what you were doing 20 years ago or what you think is changed? Reflecting on it in the last 20 years?
Well, I think hardcore fans, I think we did the Where Were We on 9/11 stories a while back. I'm happy to tell mine quickly.
We must have.
Yeah.
We do this, every year this is a topic, so we must have talked about it.
Lived in Brooklyn at the time, but I was removed from the city's collective trauma because I was on vacation that week. I was in California. And so if I had been in New York, I would have been on the subway going to work, under the towers at that time. I think I would have made it to my destination. I would have popped up on the West Village, and then would have been pandemonium all around me. And I tried to find my way back to Brooklyn after that. Instead, I woke up in California with a phone call saying, turn on the TV. And I happened to be at a place where, like, didn't even have cable. I had rabbit ears TV. And it was this fuzzy picture. And I'm looking at this fuzzy black and white picture like, why is there only one tower there? And, you know, trying to make sense of what was going on all around me. I didn't get back home till several days later. You couldn't get a flight back home until several days after 9/11. And then I went down to visit Ground Zero and try to absorb the magnitude of it. But I always felt like I wasn't quite in the same emotional space as everybody else in New York City because I wasn't literally there. Before I get into broader thoughts, why don't you talk about where you were?
So I was in Roanoke, Virginia, doing a campaign training school for the Leadership Institute. It happened. We continued the school. We did an entire day of political training because our theory was, you know, democracy goes on. And I didn't fully grasp the magnitude of it until I started driving back into Washington, D.C. Like everyone else would probably be leaving. I was driving from Roanoke, Virginia into the D.C. area, and it was very eerie. The road, this is at night, the roads are completely empty, except every once in a while, a military vehicle would speed by. And I remember seeing, it must have been like, I'm thinking reserves that were called up, but soldiers in uniform, like holding American flags on the back of these trucks, zooming past me on, I think it was Route 81. And the last thing I wanted to do was come back to D.C. I was tempted to keep on going up to Pennsylvania, you know, up 81 north to Pennsylvania where my mom lives. But I did go back in. The other thing I just remember is what a beautiful day it was. I mean, you know, we just had one of those days here where I live now, you know. You get a couple days, usually in September, that are just gorgeous, perfect weather, and like that was one of those days.
So you know, when I look back at that time, now, I mean, to be blunt, it was a very jingoistic time. You know, I mean, we understandably lost our collective minds, you know. Made collective decisions which were not smart in the wake of that. I mean, that's not to say I think we should have done nothing. I think there are things we should have done, but we had, obviously the decision to, you know, go into Iraq, you know, didn't make sense. We didn't have a thought out policy about Afghanistan, and we muddled along for 20 years and didn't without much to show for it. I remember the whole Homeland Security Department of Homeland Security debate, which was very messy at the time, you know, I think you look back on it now for certain things, and you say, like, you know what, you go, what were we thinking? You know, if you knew now what you knew then, like, would you have made these decisions? In many cases, probably not. And you look back over all of American history, there's not a lot of episodes like that where there's a sort of jingoistic fervor. You know, America has always had a lot of hesitancy about, you know, foreign adventurism, even though we've done plenty of it.
But it's the only, I mean, it's the only attack like on the homeland of
right.
that.
I mean, and also the Lusitania, you know, and for World War One, which certainly had a similar traumatic event for Americans, at a time when Americans really thought they were kind of insulated from the rest of the world. And that was sort of a wake-up call that we weren't. But still, the immediate reaction from Woodrow Wilson was, you know, a nation can be too proud to fight, which didn't go over well in some quarters. It didn't lead to a rush to war right away. It took time for Americans to get – it wasn't even until there was news of – Germany conspired with Mexico to like take a chunk of America. Did Woodrow Wilson see the need to engage? The only purest I think I said this very recently. I feel like the only purest jingoistic parallel I see is actually Spanish-American War, where you read about it, you're like, wow, Americans really just lost their freaking minds during the Spanish-American War. And that wasn't even your attack on the homeland.
The thing I'm thinking about most right now, for some reason, is like, what if? You know, like the sort of alternate history. Like Bush, so Bush was doing compassionate conservatism. The country was already roiled because of the 2000 election. But Bush is trying to do compassionate conservatism, No Child Left Behind. You know, he's got, you know, Colin Powell and Condi Rice and
he
9/11 doesn't happen.
He just come back from literally a month-long vacation in Crawford, Texas.
Yeah.
He took off the entirety of August and they tried to do some nominal work.
White House. And obviously there were intelligence, you know, problems. But what I'm getting to is, you know, if 9/11 doesn't happen, then, you know, maybe Iraq probably doesn't happen. And if Iraq doesn't happen, you know, maybe we don't get Obama. Maybe we probably don't get Trump. I mean, you know, you could say that about it's like the hinge of history. You could say that about so many things. Or what if we had gone into Tora Bora and just got bin Laden quickly?
Yep.
I mean, just so much of our history, including the election of Donald Trump, really goes back to that moment, I think.
I mean, you can do the alternative timeline thing farther back. You know, what if Al Gore won? What if we didn't have a butterfly ballot in Florida and Al Gore won? I mean, you can't say definitively, you know, 9/11 wouldn't have happened, but the things I can say, you know, Bill Clinton took Al-Qaeda seriously. Bill Clinton was going after bin Laden at a time when he was being mocked for doing so and being told he was doing it to distract from Monica Lewinsky. And he was giving speeches about the threat of international terrorism.
Didn't Bill Clinton, maybe this is like some conspiracy stuff I read on the internet in the 90s, but like, didn't Bill Clinton have a chance to like take out bin Laden and not do it?
Forgive me for getting it wrong. I mean, I think there was one time where they didn't push the button, but there was a time when they did. You know, it wasn't like, I mean, it was a question of, you know, the quality of the intelligence. But Clinton gave several speeches talking about the threat of Al-Qaeda, threat of international terrorism, how like the nature of national security was changing in a more interconnected world. You know, he was trying to reorient the whole national security apparatus, you know, post-Cold War, and wasn't really being heard. Now, remember, the Clinton administration did stop the Millennium Plot. There was a terrorist plot plan for the turn of the year in 1100. That was stopped. You know, they had people on the lookout for these kinds of plots. And George Bush and his team had a different view of global security. They were very preoccupied on missile defense. They wanted to take money out of counterterrorism and put it into missile defense. When George Bush got the memo in Crawford in August, you know, of the threat of bin Laden, you know, Bush gave a snide, okay, you covered your ass. Like, mm-hmm. They had a fundamentally different worldview.
I'm not saying that this is connected, Bill, but it is interesting because I remember being in the conservative movement back then. Grover Norquist and others were making kind of a big push to bring Muslims into the conservative coalition.
Right,
I mean,
right.
There was a sense that, like,
Dearborn, Michigan.
Michigan, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, obviously, that would have been a different world, too. I mean, if, you know, imagine a scenario where, well, let's go farther back. Colin Powell runs in 1996. And we get the first, Republicans get the first African-American president. He probably doesn't go. If 9/11 happens, he probably doesn't go into Iraq. And what if we could have, you know, the conservatives could have done compassionate conservatism, actually, and including bringing in Muslim Americans into the coalition. You know, it's a different world.
I mean, if they wanted to build on Clinton's work on counterterrorism, and they wanted to follow through on the compassionate conservatism stuff, it would have been a wholly different administration. I mean, you can't know if either Gore or Bush, if they did that, 9/11 would have been stopped. You can't know that. But I do think that there was, you know, a game plan, if not maybe fully in place, but like a direction being taken that we lost track of, which I think had some very, very grievous consequences because they, you know, Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz and all those guys, you know, were very Iraq focused, rogue state focused. And so missile defense was their big thing pre 9/11. Then of course it was just, let's just go in there and, you know, not do regime changes. And that wasn't the right call in my opinion. And so, we haven't done a lot of analysis of those foreign policy choices because Trump's come in and been so much worse on so many other fronts that we've forgotten to really talk about. We haven't done the deep dive into the Bush failures as much lately. Even when we talk about the Bush failures, it was always about sort of incompetence in Iraq and not about this more strategic misdirection, in my opinion. And so even now, with the Afghanistan pullout, there isn't all that much talk about what is this going to mean for counterterrorism purposes, because we haven't been hit in a while. And just because you haven't been hit in a while doesn't mean you're not going to get hit.
I certainly argue that's a success, that the fact that we've gone 20 years without a major terrorist attack on the homeland is a success.
I think there are a lot of counterterrorism successes, even though it's been bumpy along the way, like a rise of ISIS, not good, but at the end of the day, contained. You know, once things started to crop up, we reoriented and broke that up.
Before we go, I want to just mention the Flight 93 heroes, because I don't think they get the attention probably that the Twin Towers and even the Pentagon get. And I think it's sad that it's now equated to Donald Trump in some ways with the whole Flight 93 election.
Yeah, but I don't think they're besmirched by that. Yeah, just because someone else tried to piggyback on it doesn't mean their heroism is forgotten.
Yeah, these guys, I think it was guys. Let's roll that thing.
Well,
it's pretty ballsy.
I don't know if you read the Carlos Lozada. Book review the other day. He did a review of like a dozen or 20 or so 9/11 books to try to synthesize what we have learned from all this. It was a really great piece. And this is hardly, I think, the biggest takeaway of the piece or anything, but he did sort of note that we know a good amount about Flight 93 because there are people were talking on their phones to their loved ones. And the decision to storm the cockpit was a vote, and so Carlos, you know, was like, you know, what's a more American thing, that, you know, a Democratic vote was taken before deciding how to deal with this immediate threat, and that the decision was the right one, and that it ended up saving lives.
All right, I'm going to read the Carlos Lozada piece. You read the Lee Drutman piece.
Fine,
and we'll take it from there.
All right. What do you got to plug?
I interviewed Eric Michael Garcia.
Oh, yeah. He's got a book out, right?
It was a really good book that I'll recommend. It's called We're Not Broken. I'm holding it up. Hopefully you can see it.
I can see it.
We're Not Broken, Changing the Autism Conversation. And we had a really good discussion about it. And I learned a lot, and we got into some really good stuff. So check it out, Matt Lewis and the News on iTunes.
Very nice. If it's not up already, I should have a piece about infrastructure reconciliation stuff, and particularly the role of the moderates, how the moderates are not in lockstep. There's division within the moderate camp on this, and what kind of impact that will have on the final outcome. So check that out. It's a monthly. I had a piece of the monthly last week, and also a piece of Real Clear Politics this past Monday, both on the Texas abortion law and you know, the monthly piece was more about how, you know, pro-choice people really need to raise hell to perhaps influence the Supreme Court as they look at the Mississippi abortion ban, you know, this term. And then on the other side, for Real Clear Politics, I talked about how this is really dicey politics for Republicans, because this is Texas, a blueing state. You know, Florida might do the same thing. They're a blue, they're a purple state. You know, these are not places where I think it makes sense for Republicans to want to, you know, hit the gas pedal. But, you know, they're making their choices. We'll see how it shakes out for them. But if I were them, this is not the path I'd be taking.
All right. On that note, everybody follow us on Twitter at DMZ Show. Check out Bill's column. Check out my podcast. And we'll see you. We're doing a DM, you know, probably. We're going to be doing one of our DM Zooms Friday. So stay tuned for that if you are a supporting member.
Patreon.
Patreon.com/Bill Scherr or Patreon.com/Matt Lewis. And otherwise, we'll see you back here in the DMZ next week.
All right. Take care.